This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DeFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 49 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please rate, review, subscribe, all that good stuff. Only three ratings away from 100. I believe we're at 97 as I last checked a couple minutes ago. So if you could throw me one of those, that'd be awesome. 100's been a goal of mine for a while, and it'd be pretty unreal to hit that. you know, I never really thought we would get that many when this whole thing started last year. So, you know, really would appreciate that if you could. Talking a little bit about previous episodes, we had Matt Tallarico, base running coordinator of the New York Yankees, on last week's show, and I've had a lot of good feedback on that. He was great in terms of just kind of breaking down, you know, not only the base running side of things for baseball, but also the speed components of stuff. As you guys know, I love sprinting and talking about sprinting, and it's a big part of what I do as a coach. So we were able to get in, you know, not only to the baseball side of things with what he does specifically with, you know, improving base running and all that kind of stuff, but we were also, you know, able to talk about a lot of mechanics, you know, building speed with strength training, all that good stuff. So you guys would love that one. Definitely check it out. The week before, we had another MLB, a guy that works with the MLB, Jim Malone, head strength coach of the Pittsburgh Pirates. That was really cool and unique in the sense that we kind of went down, you know, his experience and his journey, you know, through training and kind of where he's been in his career over the last 25 or so years. And, you know, also got to get a look at the advent of strength training and kind of it coming to the forefront in, you know, Major League Baseball, you know, in his time with the Indians and how that's kind of changed and what's happened, you know, since then and during that time and all that kind of stuff and how it's impacted today. And then also talking a little bit about a blend of, you know, the old school, quote unquote, way of looking at things as Jim being a veteran coach has a really good perspective on that and blending it in with a lot of the stuff that we're seeing come to the forefront today, whether it's new ideas, you know, the rebirth of some things, as Jim likes to say, stuff that they were doing back then, but, you know, we just didn't call it that, you know, and tech and how it all kind of comes together and the importance of blending all those things. And then the week before that, episode 46, we had Connor Harris. That was a really cool episode. I went through Connor's tweets, variety of topics, and let him expand on them, and we really had a good time with that. So check out those three episodes. I think you guys would love them if you haven't listened to them already. Coming soon, this was supposed to be this week's episode, but had a snowstorm in New Jersey Monday morning, which kind of made things difficult for me recording-wise. So next week, you'll have Zach Evanesh on the show. Really excited to have him on. I have the whole thing outlined. I think it's going to be great. You guys will enjoy that. Following him, we have, and I'm currently in the process of scheduling all of these, Craig Edwards from New Hampshire, Bob Alejo, veteran of the MLB training side of things with the many years with the Oakland Athletics. You know, really looking forward to what he has to say on various training topics. Talking a little bit about the high performance model in schools and kind of how, it really brings a level of accountability with, you know, making sure that strength coaches and their work and coaches and everything, there's like a harmony between all facets of a program. There's been a lot of talk about that the last couple of days on Twitter. So it's something I definitely want to talk about. Then we're also going to be having Pitching Ninja and Dallas Braden. I've been saying that for a while. We are still working on it. They have crazy schedules, so be patient with me on that. Eric Yeagers and Rob Hill, I should be getting that done actually this week, so that'll be coming up very soon. Just, you know, really just awesome guests coming up. I'll be having Trey Hannum on again. I believe Trey will be on towards the end of December. And then my guy, Julian Locasto, who handles all of the nutrition for the athletes at Challenger Strength and also does some training here as well. He will be on in the beginning of January to discuss, all things nutrition. I haven't done an episode on nutrition, so excited for that. Also excited to get Julian on the show. So just some great stuff coming up. You guys, you know, have a lot to look forward to, and just make sure you subscribe so you don't miss anything. Without further ado, this week's tweet of the week, before we get into kind of the nuts and bolts of what I'm talking about today, running solo on today's episode, as you guys will see. So kind of first time in a long time that I'm doing this, but it's not even going to be our usual Q&A episode. It'll be me kind of walking through, you know, facets of addressing multiple needs in a training program and kind of how that whole process breaks down and some tips I have for coaches and athletes in terms of, you know, what they need to do with the program to make sure it's hitting, you know, every area and kind of how to balance all that. So that should be fun. But before I get to that, tweet of the week, I did a Q&A on Twitter, a brief Q&A on Twitter. I was at a 3-hour christening for my little cousin and I had a little time. So I snuck my phone out for a little bit and did a little of that. And one of the questions that I had, and I liked, you know, the feedback I got on this, and I was kind of happy with my answer, were, you know, the question was, what are some of my staple in-season lifts? So first thing I said right off the bat, first and foremost, is just understand that variations are always dependent upon the individual. So, you know, make sure that you're not married to any particular variation when it comes to, you know, squatting, benching, whatever it is. Like, you just pick those variations based on the sport, the need of the athlete, injuries, history, movement patterns, etc. Just make sure you don't get married to any particular thing. So I kind of said that right off the bat. Like, I don't really have a say, okay, this is a lift that I do in season. It's more of like one of my philosophies in season. The next caveat, the next part of that that I added was sprinting and jumping are huge for power, but also the best bang for your buck to maintain or even build explosiveness. So I basically kind of, you know, alluded to the fact that you want to make sure you're doing those things in season. A lot of people kind of stray. I know I was a person that did this for the first couple of years I worked as a coach, that I would stray away from those things, you know, real, you know, thinking that, hey, like, they're in season, they don't need them as much. But, you know, what we do in the facility with focused sprinting and, you know, the repetitions we're getting and all that kind of stuff, even if they're, you know, lower on the volume side, they're just invaluable when it comes to, you know, maintaining mechanics, continuing to build power. And obviously, you know, I'm going to get to this in a little bit, we're still trying to make gains. So, you know, doing those things is one of the easiest ways and one of the least time consuming. You can do 4, 5, 6 sprints in 10-yard sprints in 7 or 8 minutes and, you know, just accomplished a lot in times where you might be limited in how long you have to work with the athlete. So between that and jumping, I do think there are, you know, two important things that you need to make sure you're adding. Always make sure you're adjusting volume, you know, of those things based on, you know, scheduling of the sport, game load, practice, all that kind of stuff. And then also taking into account jumping sports like basketball, for example, where there's a lot of of jumping going on in practice and games already. I think if you adjust the volume appropriately based on that, I think you're going to be all right. I think avoiding them completely isn't necessary. You know, especially if you're doing something like a box jump, the landing and the force on the knees and the lower body is mitigated with the box jump. And it's just a really, you know, easy way to ensure we're staying clean with our jumps. And maintaining, you know, load and doing that proficiently and all that kind of stuff. So I do think you can tailor it a little bit. Like, I might have a baseball player continue to do more of a load of plyometrics than I would a basketball player just because they're jumping so much in practice. But I don't think you need to get rid of them completely for a sport that it has a lot of jumping, for the reasons I alluded to, just kind of making sure everything stays clean and, you know, working on any kinks that may develop. So that's kind of my take on that. And then last but not least, I already mentioned, you know, knowing the athlete's sport schedule. So that's key for, you know, adjusting, you know, what the program might be week to week, you know, not getting frustrated with the fact that things are going to change because they're not going to stay the same. I tried to, like, really stay married to, you know, what I laid out in the beginning of the year when I first started as a strength coach and became really frustrated and kind of, you know, became down on myself that I wasn't doing my job with staying where we needed to. You have to understand the intensity or the energy of the kids is going to come and go depending on how much they're doing or how, you know, long the season is or what part of the season you're in. You know, if they're coming off a loss, a hard week of practice, whatever it is, you really have to understand that and just do your best to get them through with as much energy as possible. But don't, you know, force things on them because that just becomes a disaster. You know if they have a lot of games coming up. I got to work with a couple junior hockey teams and knowing their game schedule. You know, do they have a game that's popping up in the middle of a week? You know, if they're a Friday, Saturday, then Thursday might be a recovery kind of prep day for that game versus if it's a Sunday game only, then Thursday we might get after it really hard with a lower body day with some sprint work and squatting and all that kind of stuff. So know the schedule for sure. And I think that's going to go a long way in kind of steering you towards what you, you know, what changes you make week by week in the programming. And like I said before, don't be afraid to push for gains. Too many times people, you know, tend to want to bubble wrap guys in season. you know, early on in the offseason, I'm sorry, in season especially, it's a good time to, you know, push for gains. You can obviously temper that down a little bit once you get into the heart of the season or towards the end when guys are really starting to, you know, the miles are starting to tack on. And just be reasonable. Like, we can push for gains without being unreasonable and doing things that are going to get guys hurt. There's a difference between, you know, doing a set of five at 80 to 85% of your max to just maintain strength or even build strength at that level, and then go on to something else versus doing five sets of it and just totally, you know, destroying an athlete and making them fatigued. So that's a good example there. There's a big difference between that. And that brings me to my last point, is just, you know, dipping your toe in the water of adaptation, I like to call it. Think of that as like you have a couple different pools in your backyard and you can't swim in them all at once. So, you know, you have the pool that, you know, touches on strength. You might just like kind of swing your leg across that pool and kind of touch into it a little bit and just make sure you hit that that area of strength. And you might dip your toe into the speed pool and the sprinting and just kind of get a couple sprints done. Knowing that like those attributes are going to wane based on, I'm going to cover this a little bit later on in terms of residuals of training and how long max strength would last, how long that, you know, max speed or max power lasts, you know, without doing them before they start to decrease. Knowing that and being able to just kind of get in and get out and hit those areas, get the body, you know, kind of hit the body with that. So recruit the motor units with a heavier load and kind of make sure that the max strength was covered, and then move on to something else. You don't need to do 6, 7, 8, 9 sets or even 5 sets of something. Hit a heavier set of front squats and then go move on to, you know, maybe a little bit of hypertrophy work, or, you know, do 2 sprints or 4 sprints, only 2 each leg if you're doing like a sprinter start, let's say, just to kind of make sure you're getting that covered instead of running guys into the ground with 15 sprints or just feeling that you can't do any at all. So I like to think of it as kind of just dipping your toe in the water, get the effect that you're looking for, and be able to move on. And I think that's a really good strategy that I've kind of learned in the last, you know, year or so with training. And less is more sometimes, but still, you know, with that said, push for gains as much and as possible and be as responsible as possible. All right, moving on from there to the show topic I alluded to, addressing multiple needs in a training program. So my main inspiration for this was, as you guys know, and I've done episodes on this before, and, you know, if you haven't listened to it, it's one of my earlier ones, so maybe that's why. But I, as you know, if you don't know, then I'm going to tell you now. But I program in conjugate style. Basically, what that means is, you know, focusing or I guess you can say, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe this. So, yeah, okay, you have linear programming, which would be like, we're going to work on a strength block here, and then we're going to finish with that, and we're going to move on to a power block here. I like to program in more of a conjugate style because for a multitude of reasons. One, I feel like with younger athletes, unless they're really, really early on, which maybe then you could kind of pigeonhole or kind of lock down one specific thing they need to work on, like if they're very strength deficient or whatever it is, and that's usually the case. Conjugate style allows you to work on, you know, speed, strength, hypertrophy, you know, all those different attributes, power, all those different attributes simultaneously. And I'm not saying you just throw everything at the wall and kind of see what sticks, but you can have all of them implemented into your programming somehow and then some way, and basically just alter how much of each is in the program based on, you know, what your focus is, what that athlete needs in particular, and all those things. So I want to explain how I've kind of developed my system to doing that. And I think it's important because I think it's helped me a lot, and I want to see if it can help other people. But I'm also just very passionate about conjugate programming because it was what I learned from Joe DeFranco early on when I was kind of coming up and, you know, listening to a lot of his work. And obviously now I have less time to do that because I'm doing so much work myself. But it's something that definitely inspired me. His influences with Westside, Louis Simmons, basically saying that like, hey, we're going to work on maybe something, like let's say we're working strength with our squat, but some of our accessory exercises after we do our main sets of squats might be, you know, for hypertrophy to support that or whatever it is. And I think this is one of the most effective ways to program, just because if you're dealing with like a power lifter, or Olympic lifter, or a general client, let's just say, and there's somebody that like all their time in terms of physical activity is dedicated to that program, you may have a little more of an ease of time just doing a typical linear training because you're not going to be in, you know, interrupted. Things won't change, all of the above, and you're kind of just on a long-term training process. But the two reasons why I think that can change when talking about athletes is one, because sometimes you might not have all year round to work with them. You might have an athlete that comes to you for 4 months in the off season and says, okay, I have to get to these goals. To which point, like, I don't have 8 weeks to just work on strength, and then kind of just like during those 8 weeks, I'm not working on any other attributes that I might need, right? So this athlete needs to get faster, and yes, getting stronger could be a big benefit to them in terms of that. But if I just work on 8 weeks of the, so 2 months out of the 4 months that they're with me on just strength training, and I'm not sprinting and doing anything other than other things, you could kind of see where that might become a problem, because now I just spent half of the time I have on one attribute and didn't do anything else to get anything else better. And then now I'm basically going to just abandon that attribute for 2 months while I work on other stuff. So that's the first reason. Second reason is, with athletes, there's a lot of kind of, things you have to navigate around their sport for one. Even when they're in the off season, they're probably still, you know, training for their sport in some type of way. I work with a lot of hockey players. That sport's basically all year round. They're playing games and practicing pretty much year round. It just becomes a little more busy, for lack of a better word, during the actual season of, like, you know, that September through March. But even in the off season, you know, your April, May, June, July, August, they're still playing some games when they're younger. The older guys are still skating a couple times a week, getting their work in there. So you still want to work around that. And I think the conjugate style programming allows you to, you know, better adjust or have more adjustability towards some of the things that might arise, in season, out of season, whatever it is, than a traditional linear programming. So first and foremost, just know that that's kind of why I believe in it and why I do it. And, that's why I want to talk about it. So, I guess first and foremost, the number one step you have to take in terms of, you know, knowing even where to begin when it comes to, you know, determining what needs you're trying to address in a program or what have you before you even build your program is you need to assess and test, and you need to do it routinely. The number one way to know if an athlete even has, you know, multiple needs in a training program or what those needs are or what have you is to test them. So to the best that I can give you advice, I would say to develop, like, and I'll give you some of the tests that I use, and I've talked about them before. It's like you need to have a group of tests that you can perform to, I guess, give you the best feedback that you would need to determine what an athlete needs and what you're going to build into their program based on those needs. So, looking at something like the vertical jump, you know, determining lower half power. So this is going to tell me, okay, like how explosive is the athlete? And give me a gauge on if, you know, what I'm doing is effective. And we'll get to that. I've talked about that a little bit and just determining, you know, whether or not, the programmer you're using is effective. If it's achieving what you're looking to achieve and, you know, give you a really good way to know if you should make changes or things like that. But, looking at the vertical, you would do your regular vertical jump, having a static vertical test in there. And that's really key because, you know, when it comes to that, you're limiting that stretch shortening cycle and the use of elasticity in the jump. And you're kind of seeing how much, does the athlete either one possess in terms of strength base? Like if you take that static vertical, it's all based on strength and the number is very high and not much lower than their regular vertical jump, then you know that they, you know, get a good use of their force and have one high force producing ability, and two, they can use that force in the movement. Two different things also. I've talked about this before. The athlete having force producing ability and then being able to use it in power movements are two different things. So sometimes you may have an athlete who produces great force but doesn't use it during their power movements. Not to get off on a tangent, but just make sure you make note of that. And then on top of that, you could see, like, okay, if their static vertical jump is really close, they're good at producing force, they produce force well and use it in those movements. But maybe they're not, you know, getting as much as they can out of like the speed and elastic side of that equation. So maybe they're jumping a 25 static and a 27 regular vert, which means that like they're not really utilizing the stretch shortening cycle whatsoever. Those are really close. A lot of the jump is predicated on force. And right off the bat, that would tell you that they might need some more pure plyometric work versus the person who has, you know, a 20 or a 19 inch static jump and a 27 inch vertical might need, you know, more stuff on the force side of things. So those are two tests that I use exclusively, and I use I depend on them a lot to determine what I want to do with lower half training and what I'm going to prioritize when it comes to my programming. So if I have an athlete that's very strength deficient, they might get, you know, a lot of heavy heavy lifting, like let's say a lot of heavy squat or deadlift work, if that's an area that they're struggling in and I feel like it can help with that vertical. They might get, you know, some loaded jumps, right? That doesn't mean I'm going to strictly get rid of, you know, the unloaded jumps or things like that. It's just I'm going to curtail how much I'm doing of them and how much I'm doing of the heavy work based on the need. So if they're really, really deficient and there's like a 8-inch gap between their vertical testing numbers, you know, they might do 90% or 80 or 85% of the loaded jumps and the heavier squat work, let's just say, but there's still going to be a set or two of regular jump in there, et cetera. I don't want to negate that attribute, aka elasticity, in lieu of strength training. And then I go to, you know, kind of get to the end of things and I basically, you know, robbed Peter to pay Paul in the sense that, you know, I built this strength in this vertical and this force use, but my overall number didn't go up very much because of that. Now, if I have a longer period of time to train the athlete and I have 8 months, let's say I'm working up to a goal, there is a time and place for just strictly working on one thing. I'll give you an example. I have an independent baseball player I post a lot about what we do, TJ Ward. And basically, the first 6 weeks of our training were, you know, a lot of heavy loaded jumps, heavier trap bar deadlifting, or even, you know, our VBT work was on the heavier side. And my sole intention was to say, okay, like, I understand that his overall vertical might not increase because we're doing no elastic. We're not doing 50% of what goes into that, but I want to get his static vertical number from, let's say, 20 up to 22, and then know that I basically raised the floor of his vertical so that when I start mixing in the other stuff, like the regular box jumps, things like that, and start adding counter movements and all that kind of stuff, my floor would be higher, and I would now be adding to a 22-inch static vertical instead of a 20. But that's just because I had a lot of time with him. In, you know, instances where I have less time or I'm in season, whatever, I don't want to totally abandon that other attribute and lose that, because whatever gains that I did make are going to, you know, not really assist, or I'm not going to have a net gain overall because I totally abandoned one of the other areas. So kind of want to just address that first and foremost with that area, in terms of saying, like, there's a time and place. And I think that's the most important thing to note with this episode, is you need to know your unique situation. I'm giving you tips, but I think my biggest tip that I can give you is to, you know, use this advice and make these decisions based on the unique situation you have. And I'm trying to give you those tools to know, you know, how to assess your unique situation. So I kind of said comparing differences and see what they use more of. I will say most young athletes can benefit from both. So I do have a lot of young athletes, 12, 13, 14 years old, that, like, they're doing a dynamic day on day one, full body maybe, and then they're doing a max effort day two that's full body, because I do feel that, you know, those are both buckets that are probably on the lower end, and we need to fill both of them. Very rarely do I see an athlete come in and they go do a vertical jump and they have a gigantic difference between their static and their regular, which means that, you know, they're force deficient, or they're really close. I usually find that there's a reasonable gap, like 3, 4, 5 inches between the two, and I'm like, all right, well, they can really benefit from elasticity and reactive work, so doing regular plyometrics, and they can also benefit from, you know, maybe adding some loaded jumps and some front squats in that are heavier, deadlifts in that are heavier, or whatever you may have. And then basically you can use testing to give you feedback, and then as they grow and get further along, whatever, I might say, okay, that 13-year-old just did all that entire cycle. Their body received the strength or the force work a little better, and we closed the gap between the two. Or I can see that both numbers went up overall, and we're going to just keep plugging away. And then once I get to a point where I keep testing and I kind of start to see that, you know, things are trending differently, the progress wasn't the same, one area went up versus the other, I can adjust what I focus more on. So when the young athlete, you know, more so understanding that you're going to have a situation oftentimes where they can benefit from all different attributes and being working on all those at the same time, you're going to have some athletes at a young age who might just be very, very deficient in one, where, you know, you watch an athlete who's very shifty and quick, but they might lack, you know, that strength. I have some kids that come into the gym and they're these, you know, big, strong, maybe a little overweight, and they can deadlift 300 pounds and they have never done it before. But you know, put them on in a box jump, or they go to their vertical and they're jumping 16 inches. It's like, all right, well, like, they're not really utilizing the stretch shortening cycle or very proficient with elasticity. So we might have to, you know, work more on that. My older athletes are more of a case in point of, like, okay, they're a little older, so they've odds are they're either on more one side of the spectrum or the other. And, you know, if they can benefit from both, they benefit from both. But it's just, you know, kind of a way of how I attack it and all that kind of stuff. So with the lower half, those are great to use. Upper half, I like to chin up as a test of relative body strength. So, you know, you're weighing an athlete and you're getting their body weight and they're doing a chin up. Like, for example, This is a perfect example I just thought of. You have an athlete that is 180 pounds and you kind of realize that you need to get them as fast as possible. So even if it's putting on good weight, if you get them from 180 to 190, it's probably not going to serve you too well because, you know, their strength relative to their body weight is going to be a hard ratio to improve if they're gaining weight. So you might want to make sure that if they're doing any hypertrophy work, it's maybe a little less of the focus of what you're doing, or they're cutting fat while you're, you know, building lean muscle mass, so the number on the scale is staying the same. You might not have that 180-pound athlete that has 4 months to, you know, get ready for a combine that, you know, might make or break the end of their career. You might not want to give them, you know, a heavy dose of hypertrophy work early on. Like, that's not going to really do much for them. Whereas the younger athlete who's got years upon years left of training with you could really benefit from hypertrophy to build muscle and help that contribute to the strength and power gains you're trying to make. So again, another case in point, like those are things you have to kind of consider when it comes to, you know, what you're looking to achieve and given the situations and the circumstance that you're in. Now, kind of last thing on this end, using testing feedback, to determine adjustments that need to be made, you know, can also come into a situation where you might leave things similar to what you've been doing. I'll give you an example. I have an athlete of mine and it's been working with me since the end of September. And we've been running the same cycle for three straight cycles now. We're in our third straight cycle of doing this. Why? He came in and he jumped a 17-inch vert and a 12 or 13-inch, or I'm sorry, I think it was an 11 or 12-inch static jump. So he had about 6 inches difference between the two. So that kind of showed me that he was pretty, you know, poor at using his force. And I also can kind of was confirmed that that was right because his deadlift numbers shot through the air. He did like 285 his first time we tested. And by like 5 weeks in, he was pulling like 330. So like, that's not really an improvement, more so like kind of waking up, you know, his dormant ability to recruit all of his muscle fibers and motor units and stuff like that. What I'm getting at though is like, I'm going to look at that guy and say, okay, he only needs to do heavy squats or heavy deadlifts, right? Clearly, that's not true. He jumped only a 17-inch vert. So as low as his static number was, it clearly it shows that he needs to get his overall vert up as well. And we're going to need to address some aspects of, you know, elasticity. So he got, you know, a lot of resisted sprints, resisted jumps. We did heavy deadlift work. We did, you know, accelerative strength work, basically trying to drive force in the windows of those smaller movements as well on the more of the force side of things. Jumped, you know, a 22 from up from a 17 to a 22 after 6 weeks. I'm not a magician. That was just, like I said before, basically me kind of unearthing some things he had inside of him that he wasn't using. But if I see a 4 or 5 inch jump in those numbers, you know, I saw a 2 or 3 inch jump in a static, a 5 inch jump overall, like I'm not going to abandon that strategy I just used. I'm going to keep using it so it doesn't work anymore. So hold test with me again. I actually got those numbers wrong. I'm sorry. He went from a 17 to a 20-inch improvement the first time. And then he convinced me, you know, 3 weeks into our second cycle just now to do his vertical one day because he felt good. And he jumped to 22 and a half. So still case in point, we're 2 months in, 2.5 months in. He's gone up 5 inches on his vertical. I'd be an idiot to change that. I'm better off using it. And then when I see the next cycle that maybe he hasn't gone up at all, like, okay, let's do the full battery of testing and see what he might need more of to keep getting improvement. So that's something I want to make sure that, you know, is driven home in this episode as well, is not abandoning things just to do it. I talked to Connor Harris about this, but understanding that if the feedback's good and the testing results are good, it's okay to keep running those same things if they're still working. So just know that, you know, make sure that you stay patient and, you know, don't be quick to jump ship if something's working to change just to change. I told him this, like, hey, like you're doing a lot of the same stuff, you know, 6, 7, 8, you know, 10 weeks straight now, but it's getting you better. So I'm going to keep on running it. And, you know, he understands that. I think his coaches, if we understand that, we'll be better off than changing something that works. All right. So on to step two. So once you get past the, you know, assessing and explaining the importance or understanding the importance of testing routinely and kind of how that can guide you, I think the next most important thing to do is, or step two, so to speak, not even that it's more important or less important, is knowing the needs and attributes that, you know, have the most need right now. So kind of taking a step back and looking at how long you have to train the athlete. You know, is it that younger athlete or older with the more advanced training age? And the big reason that that's key is that the younger athlete, you know, is probably going to be training with you for a long time. We're going to be training in general for a long time. So you don't really have to worry about saying, like, all right, we have a certain date we have to get to. Their progress is pretty linear, in the sense that, like, they're going to be training for a while. They have a lot of time to get to a certain goal. It's not a goal that they have to reach by, like, you know, June 5th, for example. Like, an older athlete might say, okay, I have a goal I have to reach before this combine or showcase or whatever it is. So just knowing that, you know, that right off the bat is something you have to kind of take into consideration. And then also kind of seeing, like, okay, like, even with a young athlete, like, I might have an athlete that has a 15-year-old that has to go to a showcase and run a sprint for time, or an athlete with an older training age, you know, like I said before, has a certain clock they have to kind of beat, and a time or a date they have to get something done by. So those are all situations where you kind of have to know, like, what that is right off the bat, how much time you have, whatever it is. And you have to ask yourself certain questions, like, you know, is it the immediate postseason? We need to build back some lost size, you know, limit some ground impacts on fatigued ligaments and tendons, or build back quote unquote lost strength. Maybe they leave you during the in-season portion, and, you know, their training's not up to par, or even that they're doing what they should be or as rigorously as they could be, or whatever it is, for whatever reason. You know, and you need to prioritize, like I said, hypertrophy for lost size, you know, lower impact or lower intensity plyometrics, you know, build back lost strength, whatever it is. They have a long time, you know, before the season rolls around, so you know you could take it a little slower. Or you have an athlete that just finishes up the season, but they did a really good job with their in-season maintenance. They either trained with you on the same type of programming, you know, or they basically just, you know, just really maintain their progress. Or they're just someone that, you know, maybe after the season ends in 2 or 3 months, they have something independent. Like, it's not to do with the team they play on at their college or their high school, whatever it is. They have an independent event to go to or something like that they need to get ready for. So you might treat them a little differently. So I think you need to list those things, answer those questions for yourself. And then once you do that, you could basically list your overall goals, immediate main goals. So what I like to say is, whether you have 3 months to train, 6 months to train, whether you accept a new athlete who's 13 and you just have long-term things that you want to help them, you know, get to, or just some things they need to work on right away, is you're going to have overall goals. So, like, your overall training, you know, what you're trying to accomplish. And then you're going to have immediate goals, after you do their analysis with their testing and all that kind of stuff, and see what, you know, what their physical standing is, their situation, you know, how much time they have to train and the amount of time or the, amount, you know, of time per week, times per week they can come to, things like that. So you list your overall goal. So that might say to me, okay, like, I have 6 months to train, a baseball player before spring training in February, right? So I'm going to say, okay, by February, I wanted to increase their speed. They're a 7.2 runner in the 60, you know, and maybe they're, let's just say, you know, they're a pitcher throwing 90, and I want to get them a little stronger or more powerful and hope that it contributes to gains in velocity, right? So my main goals are increase overall speed and explosiveness. Let's just say we'll talk about the speed to make it easier to kind of follow. Now I say to myself, okay, so that's my 6 month goal, is to get from a 7.2 to a 6.8, or just increase overall speed. But I need to now separate that long-term goal into, you know, just like I would separate my 6 months. I wouldn't just make a 6 month training cycle. I would map out 6 months of where I want to start, where I want to finish. But I'm not a swami or a genie or a fortune teller. I can't possibly say what's going to arise or what's not going to arise, you know, in the times that I'm training. You know, 6 months, you know, what was I trying to accomplish in those 6 months? And, you know, how long do I have to get to them? I can't possibly just say, okay, well, in 6 months from now, he's still going to be training 3 times per week and, you know, going to be doing this or going to be doing that. I have to kind of go in little 6 week blocks. So make sure that you break up your cycle. And while you break up your long-term cycle into smaller, like 6 to 8 week blocks, you're also breaking up your goals. And what I mean by that is, like, the overall goal of increasing speed might be the 6 month goal. But, in the first 6 weeks, you want to, you know, build some force more so. Like, force is one of the primary goals versus, like, you're kind of just mean, like the example I gave before, like you're trying to build force, but you're doing some box jumps on the side. So force is more emphasized in the 6 weeks versus the 6 weeks after that. You see that you kind of improved where you needed to with the force. So now you're trying to, you know, exclusively build elasticity and reactivity and power, in the 6 weeks, and have a little less emphasis on the strength. So I think that's important. You need to break it up into smaller cycles. And then each cycle, I like to list what I call primary goals. So my goals for that cycle, let's say they're increased force and strength, whatever it is. So those are my primary goals. I'm not going to have my primary movements, my main movements that I use, be predicated on bar speed at 45% or 12 rep sets that take a minute to build muscle. Like, that would make no sense. Those are my primary goals. So know that and then adjust. So like, kind of, once you establish those short-term goals and you also have, your primary goals for an immediate cycle, then you can establish some of these things. So I like to break up when I, do my programming and I put things together, I like to break things up into a couple areas. So first and foremost, main movements, right? So I already listed my short-term goals. I would list that first. Goals, what are they? I want to build force production overall and, get stronger. So that's my main goal. So what are our main movements aiming at accomplishing? So if I have an athlete and their main goal is to get stronger, let's just say in the lower half, they lack lower body strength, I need to write down or say what my goals are with this primary movement as a squat, let's just say. And I need to explain that, okay, their main goal is to build strength. So I need to work in windows that are going to improve strength. I'm not going to work high reps, like I said, low percentages for speed. I want to build brute strength, brute raw force production, heavy loads, high percentages of my max, things like that. So in that section, I'm going to say, okay, like my main movements, I'm going to do this. I could say I'm trying to build power this cycle, or I'm moving more towards elasticity. I'm going to build this. So identify what the main movements and the main things you're doing are working towards, right? So if my main goal is to build strength, then the things that I'm, the main parts or the meat and potatoes of my training is going to be more towards strength, right? Then you have to look at your speed and your plyometrics. So am I looking to build force in my, sprints and my jumps and do some loaded movements? Am I looking to address more of the speed end of things and the pure elasticity and things like that? Or am I looking to kind of blend both? What does the athlete need and like, what are you preparing for? So if they're an athlete that says, okay, in 3 months or 4 months, I have to run a 6.8 and I run a 7, I might not want to spend the first 2/3 of my training just on heavy squats and heavy jumps because they're not going to get any improvement in the other, half of that equation. I might want to do more of that stuff to make sure that I'm building something they're deficient in, but I don't want to totally abandon my unloaded box jumps or my unloaded sprints or things like that. Once you have that done, again, make your speed section, make your plyo section. What are we working on? So we're, running with a little bit heavier of a load. So maybe we're running with over 100% of our body weight on the sled versus when I'm, working towards the lower end of that, I might be doing 65%. I might taper off into, 65%, 55%, whatever it is. Same with my plyometrics and my jumps. Am I jumping to only reach 15% of my max height, which is like a very heavy load? Or am I working, more towards 50%? Or what have you, depending on what I need in, based on my assessment. With that said, you could also understand that, okay, I'm going to pair, like I have a guy that's extremely force deficient. He's, he has a 9-inch difference static vertical to regular vertical. So I'm going to program, loaded jumps only able to reach 15% of his max jump height. So I get a really heavy load. The heavier load makes him put more force into the ground and build up that deficiency. But he's going to do a set of just regular box jumps afterwards to not totally abandon or lose the other, half of that equation or those qualities, right? So you kind of get an idea of like where I'm going with that. Like, identify what the priorities are with those movements and what you're going to work more towards. But just know that you can still work on the sprinkle in a little bit, making like your appetizers or your side courses, so to speak, and things that you aren't putting at the forefront, but you still want to not neglect. Once you get from there, accessories and supplemental movements. So the supplemental movement, you're basically just looking at a movement that is very similar in movement patterns. So let's just say your primary movement for your cycle or your training is a front squat, and your goal is that if you improve your front squat, that's going to improve the overall testing, metrics or goals you're trying to reach. So let's just say your front squat was your primary movement. Supplemental could be a goblet squat, even a back squat. I know it's differently loaded, but it's still a squat movement pattern, a goblet squat. You can go on and on, but now you need to look at, okay, like how much of my goal is strength? Like, do I need to build strength, you know, decent, like at a 5 out of 10 urgency or a need, or a 6 out of 10? And I could have my supplemental movement be a little more, you know, hypertrophy based to build some muscle. Or am I like really, really strength deficient? I have a little bit of time to get where I need to get with that. And I'm going to say, okay, like my supplemental movement's going to also be heavy. So I might have an athlete, like I have an athlete who trap bar deadlifts really for max effort, you know, high percentage of their one rep max. But then we move into a back squat afterwards for 5 reps and under, because they need to build strength overall. And then they might have only 1 or 2 exercises at the end that are hypertrophy. But I realize that, you know, their age, they're going to build muscle pretty well with, you know, low reps and high weight as well, and still gain the strength that I'm needed to, versus saying, okay, they're only going to do a deadlift. Their main movement is a trap bar deadlift. They're only going to do that for strength work, and then everything else is going to be reps. So now I'm not getting as much strength focus as I could, versus, you know, doing 3 movements to start my training day on my lower body that are geared towards strength. And then maybe doing a little bit of accessory work that's hypertrophy towards the end. Now that same 14-year-old athlete now might be 17 in 3 years. And I see that, okay, like, you know, we need to put a little more lean mass on. They've built a good base of strength. So, you know, they might have a little hypertrophy, a little more hypertrophy. They might do, you know, minimal strength work, and a lot of they're doing more bar speed, BBT stuff, trying to, you know, improve the rate in which they can produce their force. They're doing more loaded sprints, loaded jumps, what have you. So that kind of gives you a little bit of idea on how things could change from a young athlete up to an older athlete and through the process of training. Another example is, you know, you can focus on a non-primary goal as a means of maintaining that attribute or building it to support the main goal. So think about it this way, like an accessory, right? Like I mentioned before with the West Side Method, Louis Simmons, they were doing, let's say, strength focused, you know, cambered bar, safety bar squats. But then they were doing, you know, sets of 12, 15 slow negatives for split squats or for goblet squats afterwards. So they were trying to support, and I've had a lot of success with this, support their heavier power-based movements with hypertrophy. You build the muscle, you build lean mass, the bigger the muscle is, the, you know, greater potential it has to be strong, you know, things like that. So the example I'm giving here is, you know, the hypertrophy might not be your main goal, but you're using it as a way to, you know, assist your main goal. So I realize hypertrophy might, you know, improve the benefits, or I'm sorry, the improvements I'm looking to achieve in strength or power. So I give myself or my athlete some hypertrophy accessories. Another example would be I give some hypertrophy accessories early in the off season, you know, versus when we're later in the off season and we're a month or two away or getting closer and things are more geared towards strength and power. And that just goes a lot into, I mentioned sport specific training, how like the, you know, you match the intensity, the plane of motion, the load, all that kind of stuff. Excuse me, I'm Googling something that I'm about to talk about and I forgot to pull it up. You know, basically understanding that, you know, you're going to kind of taper things a little more towards your sport. So I'll give you an example. Hypertrophy, doing 12 reps of a front squat takes you, you know, a minute and a half, let's just say. It's just estimate, minute and a half, whatever it is. How many movements in team sports are exerted at as close to max effort as you can get for a minute and a half versus doing a faster squat or a heavier squat for less reps where it's one max exertion for a small window. That's an example. So, you know, as I move on in the off season, I might tailor things more towards strength and power. So hypertrophy might disappear, right? Doesn't mean I can't do an exercise or two at the end, like an extra accessory, let's just say, of some hypertrophy based stuff to complement that versus when I might do hypertrophy for 5 or 6 of my exercises earlier on in the off season, right? And as I mentioned before, you're going to tailor a lot of that stuff as well to what the schedule is. So do they have you have a pitcher you're working with? Are they throwing a bullpen on Tuesday and then doing some long toss on Saturday? You're working with a hockey player. Are they getting, you know, their power skating lessons in on Tuesday? So you maybe want to do legs this day or have more hypertrophy work on this other day to not fatigue them for that. You want to make sure that their sports aren't suffering as a result of the training, but that you're also giving training the adequate time and the adequate timing of the sessions to be most effective. So things like that. From there, it really comes down to, then this is big, like I've talked about this a lot, understanding training residuals and, you know, determining, this can help you determine how often you need to perform certain tasks and, you know, may impact the attention you give them. So I think you need to have a really good idea before you even get into the nitty-gritty of this stuff is to have a chart like, you know, Isserin has, his residual training effects chart. And that basically kind of just tells you, you know, what each attribute kind of, the shelf life, so to speak. So if I didn't do aerobic conditioning for 20 days, I could still probably be pretty close to what I built up to, right? If I didn't do speed training for 20 days, I'd probably not be close to my max speed that I'd built up beforehand, right? So understanding things like, you know, aerobic conditioning and strength have longer retention. So maybe I say to myself, okay, I just did a lot of strength training work and that was a forefront of my early training, but now I have a month and a half up to the season. So I'm only going to do strength every couple weeks to kind of just hit that number and, or hit that, that load to get my body just, you know, kind of shock it and get it, kind of reset the residual, so to speak, in terms of retention. But I'm going to do more focus on, you know, the things that are closer to the speed of my sport and things like that. So grab that chart and, you know, understand the residuals and how long they last and use that to say to yourself, okay, like whether I'm in season and I realize that my athletes are getting a lot of conditioning based on the games and the practices they're having. So I'm going to focus way less on that. And that's going to be 3% of what I focus on, or even 0% of what I focus on, versus they're not getting a lot of max strength work or, you know, repeated power or speed training in those same windows. Like my baseball players maybe aren't getting as much max speed work, you know, in a 3-game stretch because either they're a pitcher and they didn't do anything, or they're a hitter and they haven't had a chance to or need to exert themselves at max speed, or even done it with enough repetition to give you, you know, the benefit or the adaptation you're looking for. So it's more important for me to take, you know, my baseball player whose coach is, you know, making them run poles, unfortunately, if they're still doing that, run poles or do conditioning at practice, but they're not having them do many sprints at max speed. So I need to say, okay, like my max speed training or my sprint training should be a little higher prioritized versus me doing any type of aerobic conditioning versus early in the off season. I might say, okay, I need to build up an aerobic base for them to support their speed movement. So we're going to do conditioning every week. I build myself up to a certain threshold and I can do it every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks. So things like that are really key. You need to understand that. So definitely check out Isserin's chart, of residual training effects. I've talked about that a lot in the past, and I think they can go a really long way, to kind of giving you an idea of like how long things can work. So not only do you have your goals, the athlete needs and all that kind of stuff, but you're also going to know how long those attributes can last and how often you're going to have to program them to make sure you keep their effects. Last but not least, and I cannot stress this enough because it's something that I struggled with early on, you know, in my, you know, I think it's just something I struggled with this so much early on. I beat myself up with, you know, having this idea that you're ever going to just develop a full, and I'll never forget this. I literally sat down when I first got my job with the Jersey Hitmen to train their junior teams. And I put together a program for 6 straight months, every exercise, every rep, every set, everything planned and spelled out. And I said to myself, all right, here's what I'm going to have and here's what I'm going to do. And I was very green and very new. I just went through a lot of certifications, learning a lot. And you have this idea of grandeur in your head that you're going to be able to create things that are just perfectly set in stone and everyone's going to follow them and all that kind of stuff. And you get whacked upside the head very quickly when you realize that it's just not how it goes and things are going to change, especially in season. Injuries are going to happen. They're going to have games you don't expect them to have. Training days are going to get shuffled around because of games or schedules or things of that nature. So the biggest thing that I could recommend is just accepting you're going to be a lot less hard on yourself, because I used to make myself feel like I was a failure if we didn't literally hit every single thing that I had planned out for 6 months in advance, right? So you need to understand right away, get rid of that. I have this in all capitals in my outline. Nothing ever goes to plan exactly how you expect. So if you embrace this, that's the first step. It's just you accept the fact that like you're not going to be able to, you know, set something up for 6 straight months and hit every single thing you had perfectly planned on. You're going to feel a lot better about yourself. And it's just not realistic. So it's not like you're like not being, you know, caring or having attention to detail or being a good coach. You know, you're just understanding that things are going to pop up and you need to be able to be flexible to adjust. You're a better coach if you can be flexible and adjust versus saying athletes have to stick to something you came up with 6 months ago. Trust me. So with that in mind, you develop your skeleton and your template, you know, with all your main goals filled out. And then you fill in variations, you know, used for non-primary movements as you go. So I say, okay, these next 12 weeks or these next two cycles are 6 weeks long. I'm going to have my primary movements based on what I feel like my needs are. They're going to be centered on, you know, max strength. They're going to move on to some dynamic effort work, whatever it is. I'm not going to program every single variation I'm going to use for my single leg work, my hip work, whatever it is. I like to change those. And I think one of the most important things is, one, you know, you think of new things to do as you go. Maybe you come up across a new variation. You see something come up in the way the athlete's moving while they're training that you want to address. And above all else, you're maintaining variety. Like, no athlete wants to get a program that has the exact same accessory exercises for 8 straight weeks. If you want to find a really easy way to make an athlete resent training or just hate it or grow tired of it or just hate you, that's a really easy way to do it. So I know a lot of my athletes have really enjoyed, you know, my ability or my, you know, desire to keep things differently. So there's a plan, our plan metrics, our primary movements and our speed work. I have a dedicated plan, but, and then I might say, okay, like hypertrophy is going to be what we, you know, kind of get after with our accessories. But I also understand that our accessories are going to change. The variations are going to change. I'm not going to use the same quad dominant accessory for 8 weeks, or I'm not going to use the same core variation for 8 weeks for anti-rotational. Like, I'm not going to have an athlete do, you know, the same Palloff press 8 weeks in a row. It's going to probably still work, but it's going to make them sick of it. Their body might adapt, and there's just so many things. So expect the wrinkles and also embrace them and use them to your advantage to keep things kind of varied and make things fresh and all that kind of stuff. The other thing is too, if we're talking about in season or even off season, when, like I said, they're working with their other coaches and their sport or whatever it is, you can't be adamant about sticking to something you planned out 6 months ago. I can't look and say, okay, I just put an entire in season 6 month plan together for a hockey team, and you know they played 6 games in 12 days, and I'm adamant that they have to do this heavy leg day I have planned when the kids are shot. Someone might get hurt, or I'm going to overload them to fatigue, and the training's going to have no benefit whatsoever. I'd have to be really stupidly stubborn to keep kind of like pressing the issue on that. So I think just overall, make sure that you outline your primary movements, have your skeleton, and have the main things you're doing kind of set in quote unquote stone. It's never set in stone. Like, have them set pretty strongly, and then I'll leave a lot of the rest of the stuff to be kind of determined by situations, ability to change things and give your different looks and variations to the athlete, make it more fun for yourself. So even when it comes to like, okay, you're growing and you have more athletes to coach or more things to program, I do programming every week. I'm not doing an entire program every week, but I only do a new program and build out a new goal-based kind of list every 6 to 8 weeks when the cycle's over. But every week I take the template of the week before. Let's say I would copy and paste it into my Excel. I run through, I leave all of the things constant that are remaining constant, and then I add changes to things that I can change to give variety to my athletes. And when those 6 to 8 weeks are over, we test. And if the primary movements, the plyometric movements, the speed, whatever it is, have to change because of what I saw, then I change them. But if I got good results and then everything's kind of status quo on, you know, the scheduling and how long I have to train them, we're going to keep rolling with it. So I need to kind of put a bow on all of this. I think that's the best way that I would explain it, is to have your template, you know, have the things that need to be kind of more structured, be structured, and then allow yourself flexibility. And the best ability is availability, right? So making sure you can adapt things for your athletes based on need, where they are in the season, all things like that. I think if you can really kind of accept that as a coach and get good at doing that, it's going to go a long way into you know, making your athletes enjoy the training more, making the training more effective, and just being the best you can at just kind of adapting or adjusting to, you know, what the crazy schedules of an athlete will throw at you. And with all that said, to kind of finish up, I think, and I haven't really alluded to this yet, I think keeping yourself accountable in the sense of tracking everything is just something huge that can go a long way in really improving your ability to program, address the needs of your athletes, and adjust things based on, you know, needs and just all the different things that can kind of get thrown at you. I think keeping yourself accountable to track everything in terms of like primary movements and weights being used and loads and all that kind of stuff is very important, because it kind of gets you out of the habit of just kind of throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks, and just saying like, all right, we're going to do 5 reps this week, and, you know, arbitrarily saying we're going to do 3 the week after, or what have you. I think if you're organized and you have that, it's important for you as a coach, but I also think that the athletes begin to notice it and look at it, and they'll subconsciously, honestly, from what I've seen and experienced, start to track things themselves. They'll look at you and say, oh, like, I did 250 for my squat last week, like, I want to go for 255 for this, whatever it is. So I think that's extremely important. In terms of tracking primary movements, we're looking at percentages. So what our goals are, in week 1 of a cycle up to a, you know, all the way to the week 6, and how we're going to build up to there. You know, we're tracking the load that they use and what they were able to get, for their working sets. We're tracking the volume. So how many reps, what percentages, how many sets, et cetera. And we're just looking to gradually progress. Like, I like to treat cycles as like little mini levels. So, you know, getting yourself to build up to a new 3 rep max or a higher max on your front squat, and how that kind of contributes and is a drop in the bucket towards your overall progress, and using that 6 weeks to build up to that. Excuse me, not just like aimlessly lifting the same rep schemes week after week, month after month, you know, building yourself up to something. And I adopted that from what I learned from the powerlifting world and what they do. And I think it's been huge for me, is it pushes progress. And, even with something like strength training, you know, gradually dropping the reps and upping the load is a really good way to, you know, adjust the nervous system or acclimate the nervous system to the heavier loads. And, I think it can be really effective. So that's definitely a tip that I have there. You also want to make sure we're tracking sprints and plyometrics. A lot of people think that, oh, it's just sprints or just jumps, like, not treating it the same as a squat, a deadlift, a bench, whatever you have that you're using. You know, they're extremely important to keep track of in terms of volume. You don't want to aimlessly add or subtract volume. I see a lot of coaches just like, oh, like, why are we doing 6 sprints this week? Why are we doing 2 sprints? Whatever it is. You want to make sure you know the rest that's going in or that's required, the amount of total yards you're sprinting. Are you doing a new sprint variation or a new progression to a jump? Or are you going from, you know, 2 legs to 1 leg with a jump? You know, adding too much stimulus at once can be to the detriment of the athlete. So, like, going from 2 legs in a jump to 1 leg and keeping the volume the same, or adding a single leg jump in addition to the bilateral jumps they were doing beforehand and keeping the reps and the sets the same of the bilateral. Like, you have to understand that that's a lot on the nervous system. It hits the athlete pretty hard. So, you know, if I'm going from a regular sprinter start to a mountain climb or a push-up, whatever it is, I'm already hitting the body hard enough by changing the variation as it is. So I don't want to, you know, do 10 sprinter starts the week before and then drop to a mountain climber and do 10 again. I'd like to, you know, taper the reps down of the new start type and, like, let them build up with that. You don't want to hit them with 2 different things. You don't want to hit them with a new stimulus of a start and then keep the volume where it was. It's just a lot. So definitely track sprints and plyometrics as well. This is another tip that'll drive you less crazy, because it's going to be really hard to do all this, especially when you have a lot of athletes, is be less stringent with supplemental and accessories in terms of tracking. You don't have to track every single, like, reverse lunge and, you know, goblet squat and farmer's walk weight that your athletes do. They're going to change. Like, the variations, like I said before, are going to change from week to week anyway, if you're giving variety and not kind of making everything set in stone. So if I'm doing a dumbbell reverse lunge for my single leg exercise, and then I do a real, like, elevated squat the week after, or a step up, like, keeping track of those is going to be kind of pointless, because I'm going to be changing the exercises. Also, you might, you know, be doing these accessories with, you know, more or less energy, depending on circumstance that preceded the session, what you did that day. So maybe you did a 5 rep set for your squat and your accessories you have a little more energy for, versus you did 3 and you had a little less energy. So depending on the circumstance, just, like, understand that those things are going to kind of go up and down, and really have an idea of your primary movements, your sprints, and your jumps, and then leave the accessories kind of, like, to whatever they can handle that day, you know, with good form and to push themselves. Or if they have to go a little lighter with them because maybe they have a game in 2 days and you want to just kind of get in and get out and get your primary movements in, and then just do a little bit of accessory work. Don't go crazy with tracking those for those reasons. They're going to fluctuate based on the circumstances surrounding everything. So kind of wrapping up now, moving on. I think I addressed everything that I wanted to in terms of, you know, getting through all of this programming type stuff and addressing multiple needs and all that kind of things, like all things like that. Obviously, as I always say, if you have questions on anything that I mentioned in the episode, shoot me a DM, email, whatever it is. I try my best to answer those. I've been doing the show notes and show timestamps last week. I was a couple days late, but I still got them up. So check those out as well. If there's something you want to go back and listen to specifically in this episode, being that it's one that's just kind of me running solo and kind of giving a lot of information, if you want to look to those as reference for, you know, certain areas that you might want to hear again or that are important to your situation or whatever it is, definitely check those out. They're really helpful. As I mentioned before, and I hate to ask twice, but it's really important to me. Please help push the show to 100 ratings. That'd be huge, and I'd be thrilled to hit that number. We're at 97. We're close. We can do it. I appreciate the support as always, so thank you guys. Also, keep doing this. Look for updates on upcoming guests as always. I tweet them out. I put them on my Instagram story, whatever it is. Also, just know that like there's so many ways to get this show going directly on my Buzzsprout feed. I have a Linktree kind of link cluster in my Twitter and Instagram bio. So that's got my Spotify feed, my iTunes feed, my website that has it, my Buzzsprout feed that has it. Like if you have an Android, an iPhone, a friggin' stone you're listening on, there's every platform you can imagine on there. So I've had a couple people reach out and ask, you know, if they were going to be updated on the website. So I started being a little more attentive to that. I used to just make sure I got it out on Spotify and iTunes and then would update my website every couple weeks. But it has been made clear to me that a few people definitely go to the site to listen as they don't have iPhones or Spotify or whatever. So I've been doing those week by week. And like I said, look for updates on upcoming guests. If you have anyone you'd like to have on the show or a coach that you know or whatever it is, you know, shoot me a DM, tag them in one of the posts, whatever you want to do to kind of get my attention. And as always, please give feedback and ask questions. And you know, I do use the questions for future show topics. I'll answer them whenever I can in my DMs, whatever it is. So as always, thank you guys for listening. Look forward to having Zach Evanesh on next week and some more cool guests coming up. As always, I hope you enjoyed. Peace.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DeFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.